You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's a wide world of movies out there. A Wisconsin film expert joins the show to share some great foreign language films and how to get started. Now, fresh summer produce is filling grocery store shelves and farmers market booths as we head into the middle of summer. But what do we do with all those veggies? It's Food Friday, and our guest has lots of advice on making the most of the season. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What summer produce do you always have the most of? What do you look forward to? What fruits or veggies do you enjoy cooking with in the summertime? Do you have a favorite recipe? What do you do with all the zucchini that's on the way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Aaron Clark is a Wisconsin-based cook and founder of Well Plated by Aaron, a blog with healthy and affordable recipes. She's the cookbook author of The Well Plated Cookbook, fast, healthy recipes you'll want to eat. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. What kind of produce, Aaron, do you have filling up your kitchen right about now?
I mean, should we just talk about the Z word? Like, I think we should just get right after it. Funnily enough, we don't have, I have a really small yard and we don't have room to grow vegetables. So I have a proliferation of herbs, which I love. But I always say I don't need to grow my own zucchini because I have people in my life who grow zucchini. And like, I feel like I'm just going to open my back door one day and there's just going to be a huge bag of it. And I'm just going to have to come up with something to do with it. But it's kind of a fun problem to have too. I love zucchini, both for sweet and savory recipes. So it is a quote unquote problem that I look forward to every summer.
And you know, I've got some zucchini in my garden. I'm not a great gardener, so it's going to be a little while yet before I have the produce. Grilling. You're a big fan of grilling zucchini and of eggplant, which I also planted this year, and I've already eaten, you know, one little guy. Talk about grilling those zucchinis and eggplants.
That is just our go-to simple summer side. I think people, when we think about grilling, we tend to immediately turn to meat, but vegetables are phenomenal on the grill. Even if you think that you don't really care for eggplant, if you slice it thinly and throw it on the grill with some olive oil and seasonings, it comes out so tender. You get that nice char flavor. Cauliflower is also phenomenal on the grill. This is going to sound like a weird word to use, but it almost tastes meaty. And another trick you can use to give your grilled vegetables even more flavor, my favorite way to season them is with steak seasoning, believe it or not. So a rub that you would normally use for a steak, try it on some cauliflower, try it on your zucchini or eggplant. It gives it a really rich, peppery flavor that combined with that signature char from the grill is so delicious. You know, a big plate of that, you know, maybe just like a caprese salad and some shrimp or whatever on the side if you want. Like, you can have a summer dinner with almost no cooking at all.
Yeah, you know, actually for years in my house, the go-to zucchini seasoning was a certain chef's BAM hamburger seasoning. What is it about that? Why does that work so well with zucchini? The stuff you'd put on beef, it tastes great on zucchini.
Yeah, you know, something that I love about zucchini, other than the fact, I mean, it's healthy, it's super fast, but if you think about it, it's pretty mild. So I feel like whatever kind of seasonings you want to throw at it, it is an excellent vehicle for that because the zucchini is not going to take over. It's just going to let that yummy seasoning shine. Or, you know, maybe our brains are just wired to love hamburger seasoning. Whatever the reason, I'm here for it.
We're talking to Aaron Clark on this edition of Food Friday. Aaron's the author of the Well-Plated Cookbook, Fast Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. We are talking about summer produce, what's with us now, what is coming in the weeks and months ahead. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you excited about in your garden, your farmer's market, showing up fresh at the grocery store? What are you cooking with it? Do you have questions for Aaron about what to do with product X? And what is your solution for zucchini overload? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Aaron, you mentioned you've got a lot of herbs going. We've got some on our porch too. Basil, and you've got a recipe. We've got this at WPR.org/Food Friday for your basil pesto. Talk to us about the basics of pesto making.
Definitely. So I think when most of us picture pesto, we think of that classic Italian basil pesto, which is phenomenal as everything from a sandwich spread, pasta sauce. You can marinate with it. And it's a great way to use up a lot of that fresh basil and just take advantage of that abundance. But basil is certainly not the only option. The basics of any pesto are going to be some kind of green, whether it is herbs, or I actually like to put spinach in mine too to sneak in a little veggie. Nuts. So pine nuts are classic. They're also really expensive, but you don't have to use pine nuts. You could use walnuts, cashews. You can use sunflower seeds if you have a nut allergy, and then olive oil and Parmesan. And you really can play around with that to create some unusual combinations with what you have. So for example, if your parsley is doing great, try a pesto with parsley and almonds. I really like kale and mint and pistachio together. You really can have a lot of fun with it. And I honestly just can't think of a way that you can go wrong.
Yeah, I got to say, Erin, there's a turning point in my life, because it used to be like, okay, I'm making pesto. I must precisely, they say basil, I use basil. They say pine nuts, I use pine nuts, and so on. When I realized that you could do the stuff that you were just talking about, like I could do cilantro and almonds, and I don't know if it's pesto anymore, but it's awesome. Like, we could really experiment with this stuff.
It's true. And it's one of those things in the kitchen where it's so fun to be creative. Pesto, you know, whatever you want to call it, it just brightens up dishes. It makes them taste so just alive and like summer. And it's one of those moments for me where I feel like, yes, like isn't it just such a good feeling to be like, I made something awesome.
Yeah.
And then if you grilled it yourself or it's local, that is just like even more pride that you can put into cooking. It's just really beautiful and really fun.
And, you know, one thing is, if you have too much of something, like your basil's gone nuts this year or something, you can make the pesto and then you can freeze it, right? Could you talk about a little bit about the freezing of the produce that's out there now?
Definitely. So there is just nothing better on a Wisconsin winter day than busting out a container of the pesto and just bringing a taste of that vibrancy back to kind of beat those winter blues a little bit. The biggest tip that I have for freezing pesto and storing pesto in general is air is its enemy. The second the air starts to touch the surface of the pesto, it really steals its flavor. So what I'll usually do is portion it into small containers. I even have some friends that like to use ice cube trays for their herbs, and then they'll just, you know, pop them in a pot of soup. For us, I usually do a little bit bigger, kind of what I would need to do a pot of pasta. And then I really press the plastic wrap against the top to get rid of all that air. If you don't want to use plastic, another great option is that you can just drizzle some olive oil on top, and that provides a nice seal for it too.
Now, my wife just did this with some basil stuff. And I think the warning here is that ice cube tray is now dedicated to herbal products. Don't think you're going to go back to using it for ice anymore.
Oh yeah. Unless you want like a little garlic kick to your water there.
And I don't. I really don't.
No.
All right, again, find that basic pesto recipe with variations at WPR.org/Food Friday. Oh, yeah, right. Before we move on from that, you've got a tip. If people are like, yeah, I want the pesto, but I'm vegan or I don't want dairy for whatever reason, what are options if we don't want the Parmesan in it?
Definitely. So, I mean, your first option is you can just leave it out. Parmesan adds a nice kind of salty and umami type of flavor. So you're going to want to season it with a little bit of additional salt to taste to make up for that. I would recommend toasting your nuts for pesto. I like to do that anyway. You can kind of get away with skipping it if you're using Parmesan, but if you're omitting that Parmesan, toast the nuts first just to kind of build some of that flavor back in. And then another fantastic alternative is a product called nutritional yeast, which when I first saw it, I thought seemed like really weird and hippy dippy, but it's not. It's available at the grocery store. Like, you know, you can pick it up at Pick and Save, and it has some health benefits, but I really love it because it has that same umami and almost cheesy flavor that Parmesan cheese does. So you can swap that. I would use a little bit less nutritional yeast. So if a recipe calls for a quarter cup of Parmesan, which is 4 tablespoons, I would maybe dial it down to 3 tablespoons on the nutritional yeast.
We got an email from Grant. Grant says they discovered a fantastic Mexican herb called papicha, P-I-P-I-C-H-A. Has an aroma and flavor, Grant says, that resembles cilantro or lemon basil. Great mixed into a focaccia dough or in addition to any dried bean dish. I feel like I've heard this name and I know absolutely nothing about it. So I'll call myself 90% stumped, Erin. How about you?
That is really unusual. I really enjoy shopping at the farmer's market. I haven't seen that around, but I would love to know if I can find it or grow it myself. I'm just reading a little bit about it now. I love the focaccia idea. It looks like it's great on fish and in some different soups too.
Oh, yeah. I came across it. Somebody was talking about Oaxacan recipes on the show. Okay. Mm-hmm, I'm looking online. Mm-hmm. You and I are both searching online for pizza.
And I'm like,
all right. Well, we both have to try it now. Well, it's Food Friday. We're talking to Aaron Clark, founder of Well Plated, author of the book, The Well Plated Cookbook, Fast Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. You can join the food conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a gardener? What types of produce do you always end up having too much of? What's hopping out at you right now? What are you going to do with it this weekend? Do you have zucchini contingency plans in case you end up with a couple baseball bat-sized zucchini after going away for a week or something like that? I don't know. Call it at 800-642-1234. Share your favorite summer seasonal produce. That's 800-642-1234. Find some great recipes from Aaron at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with Aaron Clark, Wisconsin cook, author of the Well-Plated Cookbook, Fast Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. We are cooking with summer produce, figuring out what to do with it, even if we have too much of something. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your advice, your favorites, what's in your garden, what's in your farmer's market right now that you're excited about. What questions do you have? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go to your calls now. Mark is with us in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. I just wanted to share with you some of the things that my wife and I do with pesto. We find a store-bought pesto that we really enjoy. And we will mix it with ricotta cheese. When we're making lasagna, we'll put it in soup stock. We'll put it in our pasta sauces. It's a real good all-around spice. We're picking things up. But one of our favorite things to do is we'll find a nice store-bought pizza crust. And instead of putting down a tomato paste-style sauce, we'll put down a layer of pesto. And then on top of that, we'll put grilled onions and blue cheese and then pop that in the oven. And it sounds kind of unusual, but it is extremely good.
Mark, I love it. Thanks so much for sharing that. Yeah, Aaron, one of our go-tos is a quick flatbread pizza with pesto. Whether, like Mark, sometimes I get store-bought stuff, but if I've got good fresh stuff, there's no better flatbread pizza.
It is so delicious. We love pesto. I especially love that with some roasted tomatoes and goat cheese. My husband's more of a red sauce pizza person, so sometimes we'll actually mix red sauce and pizza sauce together. Pesto and the classic red tomato sauce together, and it really is kind of that's a really fun one to try too.
Mark, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Heather joins us now in La Crosse. Heather, hi. Are you there, Heather? I don't think, oh, it looks like she had a zucchini recipe for us. Heather, try calling back. We're not hearing you if you're talking at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Well, instead of a zucchini recipe, Aaron, you shared with us a grilled corn salad. Can you tell us about this recipe?
Mm-hmm. There's another piece of produce I eagerly wait for at the farmer's market. And I think there's a bit of fervor, like whenever the first sweet corn of the season comes to the farmer's market, there's really nothing like it. While grilled corn on the cob is delicious and classic, if you're going to a party or you want something that's just a little easier to eat, but that is still really just scrumptious and fresh and seasonal, I love to make a grilled corn salad. So you grill the corn, cut the ears off of it, or cut the kernels off of the grilled cob, and then I just mix it with some really simple like avocado, feta cheese, or you could use a queso fresco, and then a bright lime dressing. It kind of reminds me of Mexican street corn a little bit. It is to die for.
Now, if I want to make a salad like this with corn, I'm not necessarily going to fire up my charcoal grill to grill precisely one ear of corn. What are your thoughts on getting kind of a good roasted or grill-like flavor inside?
You can totally do that. So first of all, just go ahead and grill like several ears of corn. No one will be mad if there's extra. And you can add extra. That salad calls for a couple of ears. But I've actually had good luck if you cut the kernels off of the cob before they're cooked, and then spread them on a sheet pan with some olive oil, salt, and pepper, and you can actually get a really nice char effect using your oven's broiler. So I will just pop that under the broiler. Don't walk away. That's the classic broiler, like, switch that I feel like that always happens to me. The second I walk away, my broiler burns whatever is underneath it. But you can get kind of a really nice crisp color on there too. You don't get the same charred flavor, but it really gives you that nice texture.
That, yeah, it sounds fantastic. Again, find that recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday. You can join our Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234. Aaron Clark with us, author of the Well-Plated Cookbook. You can find a Well-Plated by Aaron online. You can also find a few recipes from Aaron at WPR.org/Food Friday. We're talking about what to do with our summer produce. You can tell us what you are looking forward to making this weekend at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Aaron, your advice to not walk away from the broiler reminds me of one of my favorites with kale. I like to make kale chips in the oven.
Oh, so good.
And that's one where if you walk away for 2 minutes, you're going to burn your kale chips. What are some of your, I mean, kale starts in the spring, comes back in the fall. What are some of your favorite kale-y things to do?
Well, I mean, kale pesto is actually very good.
Oh, yeah.
Try blending in some white beans with it. It makes like a really hearty, healthy sauce. We love kale chips over here too. And I'm actually a huge fan. I know they've gotten a bad rap, but I love kale salads. In my cookbook, I have kind of a build your own. I call it the three killer kale salads that will take you through the seasons. The biggest difference is if you chop your kale into really super fine ribbons, and then you've got to massage it. So I just sprinkle it with a pinch of salt, and then you just get in there with clean hands and grab handfuls of it for several minutes. And what you'll notice happens is the kale turns dark green and becomes more fragrant. Massaging it breaks down the fibers, and it gives it almost this buttery texture. And in addition to being super, super good for you, because kale is a heartier green, that salad can last in the refrigerator for 3 or 4 days. So on the weekend, I love to make, just massage a whole bunch of kale, like toss together a salad with a little bit of salad dressing. And then I kind of just pull from it all week, liven it up with a little more dressing. And it just makes getting a healthy meal on the table so much quicker and easier.
Now for me, I like kale in any form pretty much, but to me, fresh kale versus something I get at a grocery store out of season, that's one of the biggest differences. Like that fresh stuff, like it's way more tender, it's less bitter. I don't know. That's one to really enjoy fresh, I feel like.
Totally. The stuff in the grocery store we'll use for smoothies sometimes. If you add pineapple or mango to a kale smoothie, and then along with a tablespoon or two of peanut butter, I don't know, there's something magical that the pineapple, especially in peanut butter, due to kale, that just makes the kale sort of fade into the distance. Like, even my husband, who, like, the first time I made a kale smoothie, he was like, get that away from me. Now he makes them willingly, which I'm pretty sure is the biggest endorsement that I can offer.
You got your peanut butter in my kale. Yeah, I wouldn't have thought of that one, I guess.
I know it sounds, I'm going to be honest, it sounds weird. Like I said, you're listening to this and like, why would I put that together? Just give it a try. Just open mind.
I might give that a try. Now, preserving. Now, you and I think, are on kind of the same page. I used to like actually can. I had a canner. I would can things. Now I don't, but I'll like fridge pickle to do stuff.
Oh,
and you
so
do that
good.
Too, I understand. What are a couple of your favorite things to do, just a quick, you know, toss it in vinegar or whatever and have in the fridge?
I would say having pickled red onions on hand will just make everything in your life better. I love to add them to salads. They're great added to grilled cheese, tacos. I mean, sometimes I will honestly just like snack on them a little bit out of the fridge kind of while I'm cooking. But that truly, when you're talking about maximum reward for minimal effort, it's hard to beat pickled onions. And I do have a recipe for pickled onions on my website, wellplated.com, for free. All my recipes are free. But if people are specifically looking for the one I make, that's the one I make.
Yeah, I love red onions is the go-to thing for me to just like toss those quick. And use them in a meal later in the day or later in the week.
I want to try radishes. Like, I feel like radishes and jalapenos could both be really good too. So those are on my list for taco night next.
I'll say I do radishes. My one warning is there's something magical about the smell of even a quick pickled radish. It's terrible. But it tastes really good. So just prepare to have your fridge dominated. Maybe give it an extra couple layers or something with the quick pickled radish. That is my warning.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I appreciate
it's chemistry
I appreciate
or something.
That.
Now, okay, we've mostly been focusing on summertime vegetable stuff. And fall, though, is my favorite season. Give us a sneak preview. What are you excited about as September rolls around?
I just love butternut squash so much. I know most people are really excited for pumpkin. And, you know, pumpkin certainly has its place, but the yellow squash that forever has my heart is butternut squash. I just like roasted in casseroles and soups. I can't get enough. And then here in Wisconsin, especially, I'm so excited about apples. I love to go apple picking. Always way overpick on apples. So that turns into the same problem as my zucchini. Fortunately, apples last a long time, but I'm looking forward to using apples in all kinds of sweet and savory recipes this fall too.
And that reminds me, I skipped another recipe. You gave us a peach crisp. I'm a huge crisp fan because it's easy. You don't have to make a pie crust or anything like this. Peaches in our crisp. Tell us about it.
That is a summer. I just think it's so cruel how short stone fruit season is, especially peaches. When you need a dessert that people are just going to go crazy over, you really just can't. A peach crisp, summer peach crisp with vanilla ice cream, it really just does not get any better than that. It's almost dangerous because it's so quick and easy to stir together. And, you know, once peaches sadly fade into the background, you know, you can use that same recipe with apples. I've actually done a mix of apples and pears together. That's really nice. You can do, if you don't have enough peaches, I just did a peach and blueberry crisp last week that was absolutely fantastic. There's lots of room for playing around, and it's a peach crisp is a very user-friendly dessert. So I always say that is a great one for anyone to make. And yeah, people just go crazy over it.
Erin, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
That's Wisconsin's own Erin Clark, founder of Well Plated by Erin, author of the Well Plated Cookbook. She joined us on Food Friday to talk about cooking with great summer produce. Find some of those recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. By the way, got a follow-up from Grant, who talked about that Mexican herb called pepicha. He says he found it at the Hilldale Farmers Market in Madison. So it is findable here in the state. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, summertime is a time to take care of our skin, get advice on using sunscreen, and find out why some of the world's best sun protection may not be available here in the United States. Huh. That's today on Central Time from 3. Oh, sorry, that's Monday on The Morning Show. Archaeological discoveries can paint us an amazing picture of human life in a different era. The remains of Pompeii frozen in time by a disastrous volcano. Egyptian tombs unsealed after thousands of years. And now, a Burger King at a shopping mall sealed up for more than a decade. The historic-ish find comes from a shopping mall in Wilmington, Delaware. It started a couple months back when a contractor working at the mall shared a picture online. There was a gap in one of those fake walls that malls use to block off closed stores. The picture showed a 1980s-era Burger King restaurant fully intact. Since then, local media outlets followed up the story. The Burger King in question opened in 1987, closed in 2009 with that original 1980s decor in place. Usually malls use those fake walls to hide the empty space till something moves in, but nothing did. So there it sat, undisturbed for 13 years. Who knows what secrets the lost Burger King of Wilmington might reveal? As a great archaeologist once said, that belongs in a museum. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, we here at Central Time enjoy our movies, as we know a lot of you do too. In the past, we've talked about the all-time great movie musicals, animated pictures, movies, soundtracks, and more. Today, we put the spotlight on another big part of cinema, foreign language films. You might have noticed some more recognition for these movies at the Oscars in the last couple years. Drive My Car and Minari were recent nominees for Best Picture. In 2019, Parasite became the first foreign language film to take home the Best Picture title. But there's a world of movies out there. Where do you start? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite foreign language films? If you do watch them, do you remember the first movie you saw that was in another language? Have you seen any of those recent foreign language Oscar nominees? If you avoid them, what's the biggest barrier for you? And if English isn't your first language, what was your first exposure to English language movies? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is an associate professor of English and film studies at UW-Milwaukee. She wrote the book The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship and Modernized American Theater Architecture. Jocelyn, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here as always, Rob.
Let's start with the elevator pitch, Jocelyn, for somebody who's maybe reluctant to check out films that aren't in their native language. Let's say English for now. Make the case of what we have to gain.
Yeah, you know, there are so many ways to tell a story out there, and they really are not restricted to the way that we tend to do it in English-speaking film, whether it's American or Canadian or films made in the UK or anything like that. If you restrict yourself to just those kinds of narrative, you're missing out on the absolutely massive amount of film that's available around from around the world. And right now, with all sorts of streaming accessibility, this world is available right at our fingertips. It's just a watershed moment for having access to films from all around the world. It's the perfect time to get started. And if you don't do this, well, you miss out on ways that culture is just this incredibly constantly evolving and moving thing. We might recognize national borders as things that are kind of rigid, but culture doesn't. And so it's a really great time to open yourself up to all the different ways that you can experience how stories are told from around the world.
And as I understand it, you know, Hollywood movies and other film traditions, they kind of talk to each other and influence each other and shape each other. Where can we go to see some of the things that might have influenced some of the movies we've seen and vice versa?
Yeah, this is such a wonderful example of how English language film, especially for our case, Hollywood film, has an impact on foreign language film, and then foreign language film has an impact on what happens here as well. So one of the great examples we can think about is the French New Wave in the 1950s and 60s. And we think about this as kind of like the height of intellectual filmmaking, right? Jean-Luc Godard, François Truffaut, they really transform how we understand how movies work. But this didn't come about generous, right? They didn't just like come out of nowhere developing this. They were actually deeply inspired by American filmmakers like Orson Welles or John Ford, even Charlie Chaplin, Howard Hawks, right? So if we think about somebody like Godard and his really, really famous film Breathless from 1960, which really puts the French New Wave on the map around the world, that film is deeply inspired by American film noir, right? And later he makes things like Alphaville, which is of course very influenced by science fiction, especially American science fiction. Or we can think about other films that move from language to language, something like one of the first foreign language films that I saw, Purple Noon from 1960, which is directed by René Clément. That was made in French as well as Italian and English, but it was based on Patricia Highsmith's novel, The Talented Mr. Ripley, which was written in English. And then, of course, that novel is then remade into another movie in 1999 called The Talented Mr. Ripley that is made in English. So we can see that there's always this kind of like back and forth conversation. And it's really a wonderful way to understand how these stories transform via different directors and different filmmakers in different parts of the world.
We are talking to UW-Milwaukee film professor Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies. She is begging and pleading with us to check out some foreign language movies. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like to watch foreign language films? You can name names if you have favorites. Do you want some suggestions? You like this, so what might you like? Jocelyn might well have an answer for you. Are the subtitles an obstacle? They are for a lot of people. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Jocelyn, the subtitles are a hurdle. It seems like an extra work sometimes. Some people in my household, I won't name names, so they sometimes watch phones while they're watching films on the TV. I don't know. How do we overcome that subtitle hesitation if we have that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wish I could solve the scourge of people looking at their phones while they're watching movies, but that's beyond the foreign language problem, right? But I understand this, and I actually get it from my students too, many of whom have never seen a foreign language film before they come into a film studies classroom. And I think there's a lot more of anxiety around subtitles than there really, really needs to be. The number one thing that I always tell my students and that I would tell anybody who's feeling a little bit reluctant to dive in is just not to stress it so much, you know? A good filmmaker is going to provide you with so many visual and oral cues for what's happening that extend beyond what the characters are seeing. It's really important for us to remember that film is not literature. The words matter, the script matters, but it is definitely not the only thing going on. So if you miss something, that's okay, because you're going to get most of it in context. And I'll give you a little example, because Parasite, you know, just really burst onto the scene and really transformed, I think, a lot of American spectators' relationship with foreign films. There's that wonderful moment where the Kim family, who are the kind of protagonists of the film, where they're leaving the rich family's house in the middle of a rainstorm. And we watch them move from this gorgeous, spectacular, wealthy, you know, exquisite house that's kind of like at the top of this hill, literally down into the urban depths. We follow them over the course of several minutes during this rainstorm as they move into like increasingly dirtier and more cramped urban situations until finally they're at their very dingy basement apartment that's flooded. Very little is said in that sequence, but we learn everything we need to know about the family's class and position just from watching them move through the city. And that's what a good filmmaker will give you. You don't have to stress so much about trying to catch everything. You're going to understand it from the entirety of the context.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Lori is with us in Madison. Lori, hi.
Hi. In the 70s, I saw a film called La Cage aux Folles, and it was subtitled. And later it was made into a blockbuster hit with Robin Williams called The Birdcage. And I really think that there was a lot lost in the translation from the French to the English version.
Lori, thanks a lot for that call. I think I seem to recall the original of that was actually fairly successful, as foreign language films go, in the U.S., Jocelyn.
It was. And I think that's an example of how certain genres can make foreign language films really appealing too, right? Because that relies very, very much on the musical, right? That is a musical and there's a lot of music in it. And music is also something that expresses emotion past what the words are saying. So it's a great example of how a film that might be shot in a foreign language can provide additional information beyond the verbal to give us insight into what's actually happening in the story.
Thanks for the call, Lori. We're talking to Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, UW-Milwaukee film studies professor, about foreign language movies, where to start, why it's worth it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you seek out foreign language movies? Is it an area you still want to explore? Do you have a favorite, a country of origin for movies made outside of the United States? Name names, recommend movies, 800-642-1234, or ask for suggestions, 800-642-1234. We'll get some suggestions coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk about international films and movies and languages other than English with Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, Associate Professor of Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. You can join in with a movie to recommend, a question. If you need a recommendation, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Jocelyn, want to get into some of your recommendations. Now, you had one, a Japanese director named Kurosawa. And I'm like, oh, I heard him. Nope, not that one. Kiyoshi Kurosawa. Tell us a bit about his movies and why they might be a good starting point.
Absolutely. I mean, you can watch Akira Kurosawa. He's perfectly good, too. But Kiyoshi Kurosawa is one of my favorite filmmakers. And the reason I wanted to talk about him a little bit is kind of relevant in terms of what our caller just talked about, which is that he is a fabulous genre filmmaker. So there's two films that I'd point to in terms of ways to get your feet wet with foreign language films. The first one is his film Pulse from 2001, and this is a horror movie, but it's a movie about ghosts on the internet. And so it's really, really prescient because it contains all these anxieties these kind of like millennial anxieties around what the internet means and how we might lose ourselves and all become kind of like spirits or ghosts moving through the internet. It's so prescient. It's really, really scary. And it's a wonderful example of the absolutely fantastic ghost movies that have been coming out of Japan for decades. I mean, if you're a horror fan and you're not watching Japanese cinema, you're totally missing out. But he's also really good at melodrama. And in 2008, he makes this absolutely gorgeous family drama called Tokyo Sonata, which is about a family, a pretty average upper middle class family in Tokyo, where the father loses his job during the recession, but he pretends to keep going to work, and all of these kinds of rippling effects that this has on his entire family. And it's a real weepy movie. It is absolutely gorgeous. And you could hold it up next to any exquisite family drama coming out of Hollywood.
Let's go back to our callers now. Mark is with us in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. So one of the foreign language film I just recently watched in the past 6 months or so was a film called White Tiger. It's a Russian World War II movie, and the general concept is there is a white German tiger tank that will suddenly appear on the battlefield. It's almost like a ghost. It comes in, slaughters the other side, and then disappears. And at the end, there's this duel between a Russian and this German tank. And yes, it did have subtitles, but you know, after a while you get used to those, and I would highly recommend that one.
Thanks a lot for that call. That's a great moment when I have watched movies with subtitles where it hits me. I forgot I was watching subtitles, Jocelyn.
Yeah. I mean, that's when you're really, you've like hit the kind of flow state, right? It's like everything is working in conjunction with everything else in a really, really beautiful way. That's part of why I encourage people who are a little anxious about this, just not to stress it so much, because you will get to that point. You definitely will get to that point.
Mark, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. White Tiger. Jerry joins us now in La Crosse. Jerry, hi.
Yeah. Hi, thanks. I just love foreign movies. It's almost all I ever watch nowadays. I'm sort of tired of all the explosions and, you know, shootings and all that sort of thing. But I can't try. I wish I could think of more. I've got hundreds of them that I love. But one I can think of right now is, I think I'm not here anymore. I am not here anymore. It's about a sort of a cult of music fans from Mexico. I don't know if, I hope I have that name right.
I'd look it up. I'm no longer here. Could that be it?
That's it. I'm no longer here.
Excellent. Jerry, thanks. That's I'm no longer here from Mexico. Any Spanish language movies? They'd probably have a decent audience, Jocelyn, without subtitles in the U.S. Anything from Mexico or beyond you'd point us toward?
Oh, wow. I mean, so much. One of the greatest living filmmakers right now is, of course, Pedro Almodovar, the wonderful Spanish director who's had just a many decades. I mean, almost a 50-year career so far. He's been working for so long. So one of the films of his that I really, really, really love is All About My Mother or Talk to Her. They're just gorgeous films that one of the things that's so wonderful about them is that he has really fabulous leading lady protagonists. He's a male director who absolutely loves his female stars. And that's how people like Penelope Cruz, Javier Bardem, you know, all these amazing actors get their start working with Almodovar.
Thanks a lot for that call. David joins us next in Phillips. David, hi.
Hey, hi. There's one in a sequel in French. It's La Sorsa, where the source, and its follow-up movie called Manon of the Strings. This is a series of movies that is an amazing family saga and has many nuances and depth to it. I think many people will enjoy it.
Any big names in that one, David?
Yeah, Gérard Depardieu, a young Gérard Depardieu, and a French actress, I can't remember her name, very famous actress. People will know when they see it.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, David. Yeah, French movies. They've made a movie or two, Jocelyn.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. There's no such thing as the tradition of French cinema. One of the things that I'd love to point out with French cinema, and this is honestly, Rob, this is one of my favorite things to tell people about foreign films, is that, you know, we think of them as like the height of urbane sophistication, right? The French, they're so much better than we are. They eat all that butter and they don't gain weight, right? But when French films really hit the mainstream in the second wave of cinephilia in the 50s and 60s, they're not just promoted as something that a very intellectual audience would go to. They're also promoted because they have a lot more nudity in them than American films did at the time. So somebody like Roger Vadim makes the film And God Created Woman in 1956, which is famous for really kickstarting Brigitte Bardot's career. And I'm sure all I have to say is Brigitte Bardot, and you understand what a very, very sexy movie this is. And this was promoted not just as something that you would go see because it's a classy French movie, but actually because you'd see quite frank eroticism in it in a way that you would not see American movies at the time. So even though we think of foreign language films as something that like, oh, we go see that if we want to think that we're really, really intellectual audiences, they're also something that have often been marketed as something quite lascivious and risk-taking as well.
Thanks for that call, David. We're talking about foreign language movies with Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies from UW-Milwaukee. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Maquonago. Tom, hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. What do you got for us, Tom?
My absolute favorite foreign film is a film called Babette's Feast. It was made, gosh, I want to say it was made in the 70s or 80s. It's a Danish film, all subtitled, but very international cast in it. You know, has people that come in for an opera singer that sings in Paris, and then a whole bunch of different things. And it's about a chef that escapes the revolution and ends up in Jutland. So it's just a wonderful film.
Tom, thanks for that. Was a pretty big name. I haven't seen it myself, Jocelyn, but I remember that getting a lot of hullabaloo.
Yeah, that was a really, really popular film. And I actually love that example. It's a beautiful film, but it's a great example of how we can use our other senses to get into a foreign language film, because of course that culminates in this incredible sequence of cooking and eating, right? So it really is something that's trying to evoke the sensory pleasures and experiences of good food, good wine, and company. And those are not dependent upon understanding the same language. So I think that's a really wonderful example of how a foreign language film can appeal to all manner of our senses and not just the way that we speak.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Something that's nagging at me, Jocelyn, one of our callers earlier said he got into foreign films to get away from the shooting and explosions in American movies. My most sustained watching of foreign films was back in the day with my buddies. We'd watch the Hong Kong shoot 'em up genre, the John Woo and other directors. Lots of shooting and explosions in them. Like, we could find that stuff in foreign language films too, right?
Oh my gosh, of course. I mean, John Woo is a wonderful example, or Beat Takeshi, right, who makes these wonderful gangster Japanese movies as well. Not quite as acrobatic as the amazing fight choreography that we get in John Woo, but Beat Takeshi, his films are just full of, you know, a lot of violence, definitely a lot of violence, but they're also these kind of searching movies about like what it means to be a part of the criminal underworld. We definitely do not have the only violent images here. There's plenty to be found in foreign language films as well.
Now, before we run out of time, Jocelyn, you are hosting the first of two virtual screenings of a Ukrainian movie. Can you tell us what's going on?
Absolutely. The first screening is going to happen on Thursday of this week, and the second will be on April 25th. And this is a brand new Ukrainian film. It's a historical adventure set in the early 17th century. And it's about a group of Cossacks and this gold that they've been tasked to transport between the Ukrainian and Polish border. The film is supposed to premiere this year. Obviously, that's been put into a very tenuous situation because of the invasion and the horrible war in Ukraine, but we've gotten access to this film. So there will be a virtual premiere on Thursday and on April 25th. And it begins with a roundtable conversation that I had with the filmmaker and the executive producer who are currently in Kyiv. So it's a great opportunity to see a film that you would not have access to any other way.
We've got a link to registration for that screening up at WPR.org/Central Time. Again, WPR.org/Central Time. Our last half a minute or so, Jocelyn, name one more name that you think we ought to check out in the foreign language world.
Okay, I will say We Are the Best, which is Lukas Moodysson's film from 2013. He's a Swedish director known for all sorts of genres, but this is an absolute delight of a film that is a comedy about teen girls, young teen girls who start their own punk band because they're very, very angry at their very normal suburban life. And it is a delight from start to finish.
Jocelyn, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thank you so much. I love being on.
Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is an associate professor of English and film studies at UW-Milwaukee. She joined us today for a look at how to get into movies from other countries and other languages and maybe why we should. Hey, there's still time for you to share your recommendations for everyone else. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. That conversation with Jocelyn is from earlier this year, but we're still interested in hearing your favorite foreign language movies. Email ideas@WPR.org with your favorites. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, George Floyd's death at the hands of police officers led to an international wave of protest. A new book puts the spotlight on his life. Meet the authors of the new book. His name is George Floyd. Follow the path that led him from Texas to Minneapolis and the personal and societal challenges that shaped his life. Also, Monday, meet the founders of a Buy Nothing group in Appleton who help people pass on their stuff to others instead of throwing it away. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.